This episode of Blue Dot is sponsored by the Gateway Science Museum in Chico, California. Join them for the Every Drop Impact Project Forum, where community members come together to simulate water conservation planning to build awareness around droughts plaguing our area. Learn more at csuchico.edu/gateway. Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. Huge fires like Dixie and Caldor have been burning their way through the forests of Northern California all summer long, with the Dixie Fire poised to become the largest in the state's history. The fires burned through much of Lassen Volcanic National Park, destroying the historic 1930s-era lookout on Mount Harkness and taking out cabins along Juniper Lake. For longtime visitors to these green and forested landscapes, it can be depressing to contemplate what we will see when the fire is out. But the Lassen landscape in particular has been burned by wildfires for millennia and seen forest destruction from volcanic eruptions, such as the eruption of Lassen Peak in 1915. The landscape recovers, and more rapidly than you might think. Our guest is Chad Hansen, the principal ecologist for the John Muir Project, a nonprofit organization that advocates for better fire and forest management on public lands, especially national forests. I spoke with Dr. Hansen over the phone not long ago, and his message was so positive and had the science to back it up that I couldn't wait to get him on the show, and thankfully he joins us now from his home in the mountains of Southern California. Chad Hansen, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you.
First of all, I would like to know what the John Muir Project is, because I understand that was founded by Mr. David Brower, right?
The John Muir Project is a project of Earth Island Institute, and that was founded by David Brower back in the early 1980s. And so we're one of a few dozen projects that are under the umbrella of Earth Island Institute. Basically sort of our umbrella organization, but the projects function like independent organizations. John Muir Project is one of those. I co-founded John Muir Project in 1996, and we're basically a small nonprofit forest conservation and research organization.
And I saw that you have like three guiding principles that I thought was really interesting. Could you tell us about them?
Well, you know, there's different components to our work we're really about public education. We're about research, and we're also about, you know, making policy changes. We educate members of Congress, and we sometimes bring cases to court to stand up for science. You know, for us, it's all about science and advancing science to protect ecosystems and to protect communities. Increasingly, these days, we're focusing a lot on wildland fire and how to best protect communities from wildland fire while protecting ecosystems at the same time.
And of course, here in 2021, we are having a very large wildfire season, as we did in 2020. And basically, since 2012, it seemed to me, living in Northern California, that we've had, you know, just as increasingly larger fires by the year. 2018 being the Camp Fire that wiped out Paradise, California. 2020 was really bad, and, you know, the largest fire in California history. And now we have the Dixie Fire and the Caldor Fire, which are just, you know, really racing through most of the Northern Sierra Cascade region, Southern Cascades. And I would like to get your take on what this fire season, you know, is like in the big, as far as the big picture.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think that it's really important to have a conversation about two distinct things because they're very, very different. The effect of wildland fire on communities and on public safety versus the effect of wildfires on ecosystems. Two very different conversations. And I talk a lot about this in my book, Smokescreen. Again, Smokescreen, Debunking Wildfire Myths to Save Our Forests and Our Climate. It's my new book. And I've got, I wrote it for a lay audience I didn't write it for scientists, but I have hundreds of scientific studies cited in the endnotes. So there's a lot of science backing this up. And basically what it's telling us is this, is that when fire impacts a community, when homes are lost, when people get hurt, when lives are lost, that's always a tragedy. That's always catastrophic. And that's something we can prevent almost entirely. It is almost 100% preventable if we focus our attention and resources on communities, which we're not doing currently. Instead, what we're doing mostly is backcountry fire suppression and backcountry logging, and it is not working. It is not stopping these fires. They're mostly weather and climate driven fires, and that's increasingly true. And we're not going to fight them with chainsaws and bulldozers. We're going to have to pull back and focus on communities. But the other thing I emphasize in the book is that ecologically, even these big fires, you know, we've always had a mix of small fires and big fires, and the big fires are not unprecedented historically. They're just something that we haven't seen for many decades, but they're natural in the landscape. And in fact, some of the very best wildlife habitat is created by big fires, including by these high intensity fire patches that we used to think destroyed the forest, but we now understand that's been going on for millions of years, and many plant and animal species depend not just on post-fire habitat, but in many cases, they depend on what we call snag forest habitat. That's where fire kills most or all the trees, sometimes in big patches. And a lot of species depend on that more than any other habitat type. So point is, if we recognize that and understand that fire is doing really important ecological work out in the forest, and the forest naturally regenerates, then maybe we don't spend our resources and our attention on things that are not helping and are not stopping fires and are not protecting communities. Instead, we'd redirect those logging subsidies into home hardening and defensible space, things that we know save homes and lives.
Yeah, so yeah, let's focus on that aspect for just a moment, and then we'll go back to the ecology because that's really fascinating and hopeful. But what are the ways that, because if you look at where all these communities are, especially in the Sierra Nevada foothills, you know, places like the Grass Valley, Placerville, Sonora, you know, they seem to be in harm's way, you know, and should we be even living there?
Well, that's a really important question. And I think, you know, the answer is two parts. You know, where there are communities that have been there for a long time, you know, the community is already there, and it's going to be there. But when it comes to land use planning and where there's proposals to build new developments, there are some places on the landscape that are inherently risky. And I just commented in a Bloomberg News story not long ago about a huge development in the Southern California mountains that's been proposed. And this is a place where there are no good routes of evacuation. Depending upon which direction the fire is coming, you know, people can be forced in a, you know, what's proposed to be a very large community. Basically out of a bottleneck in one evacuation route, essentially. And that's inherently dangerous. And so even if you make sure that the homes are hardened and every home survives, you know, the most important thing is to make sure that people and their animals get out safely. And I think that there are some places that are inherently risky, you know, narrow ridgetops. You don't want to put a community there. That's not a good idea. They're windswept, and there's no good way to get off those areas if there's a significant population and there's little time. So I think that's the conversation we need to have moving forward. But for existing communities, you do the best you can. You do the best you can to, you know, fortify evacuation routes, create new ones if it's possible. But above all, devote resources to hardening homes and doing the defensible space, evacuation assistance for people and their animals, and things that we haven't really been talking about in the past, but I think we need to, such as construction of fire-safe shelters with smoke filters in the communities. You know, situations that are just fire-safe and, you know, are not made out of wood, you know, and structures that just simply don't burn.
Yeah, well, we definitely saw, you know, what you're referring to in Paradise, California in 2018, where it was very difficult to evacuate that population off that ridge in that fire. And that's why so many people died. And there were people that, you know, literally had to, you know, take refuge in like shopping center parking lots with fire engines surrounding them. So what you're saying makes a lot of sense to me about, you know, you have to have some, you know, like literally fire bomb shelters.
Yeah, I think these are solvable issues if we focus on communities, if we focus on public health and safety. And I believe we need to. I think it's essential that we do that. I don't want to see another Paradise. I don't want to see, you know, 86 people lose their lives and over 14,000 homes burn when most of that was preventable. If the resources had been provided to the community to do the work and to assist people, because not everyone has the resources to do it themselves. And so to me, it's not about regulation. It's about offering the assistance and directing our resources in the right places. Right now, we're spending billions and billions of dollars of taxpayer money every year on backcountry logging and backcountry fire suppression, and it's not helping. It's the wrong approach. And so I'd like to redirect most of that money into other things, and particularly into communities. I don't want to lose another Greenville or another Grizzly Flats or, you know, the long list of other towns that had been lost in recent years in wildland fires, where the fires burned right through thousands and thousands of acres that had been, you know, commercially thinned, or where post-fire logging had happened in earlier years, all under the rubric of fuel reduction. And it gave people this false sense of security that somehow these logging projects out in the wildlands are going to stop the fire, or fire suppression, or some combination of that with fire suppression forces are going to stop the fire. And, you know, you're not going to do that when you've got 30-mile-an-hour, 40-mile-an-hour wind gusts and bone-dry conditions, and you've got, you know, temperatures in the 90s. That fire is going to move in the direction of the wind, and that's all there is to it. Oftentimes, they're moving faster through these thinned areas.
Yeah, I hear that constantly. In fact, on Twitter the other day, and I did not respond to it. It was hard not to. But I saw somebody posting something about the Caldor fire that said, give me a chainsaw and, you know, I'll take care of this. I'll cut the whole forest down. You know, that mentality that if we just, you know, if we just do enough logging and cutting and, you know, thinning the forest, that'll take care of it. And we stop doing that, we, you know, because of all the environmental regulations and stopping all of the logging activity and the mill work. What do you say to people that have that point of view?
Well, look, I'm a scientist, and I have to follow the evidence. And I look at the evidence. I look at the evidence from CAL FIRE. I look at the evidence from the U.S. Forest Service. The management records and the management history are there. We know that in the CAMP FIRE in the fall of 2018, the area that it burned through was you know, some of the most heavily logged forests in the entire Sierra Nevada. That in that fateful first 6 hours, where it burned so intensely and so rapidly between the point of origin and reaching the town of Paradise. On private timberlands, there was extensive post-fire logging from a fire that burned 10 years earlier. There was extensive post-fire logging and commercial thinning on national forest lands. And all of it was done under the guise of fuel reduction. And you know, agencies and industry told the communities, listen, this will save you from fire. Well, it didn't do that. It did exactly the opposite. That's where the fire spread the fastest. It put people in a position where they didn't have as much time to evacuate. So that's a failed approach, failed strategy. Certainly fire suppression wasn't able to stop the fire under those conditions. We just saw the same thing in the Dixie Fire just a couple of weeks ago, where it burned through thousands of acres of commercial thinning up on a ridge and then just swept down and burned down most of Greenville. We saw the same thing in the Caldor Fire very recently, where it burned through a commercial thinning project on the El Dorado National Forest called the Trestle Project that we told them would not protect the community. They did it anyway, and the fire burned through that very rapidly and burned down most of Grizzly Flats. The examples of this go on and on and on. And, you know, these are places I know. These are places I like. I don't want to see another cool mountain town devastated. I don't want to see more homes burn, and I don't want to see more lives lost. And it's so hard for me to see it every fire season when I know the science is telling us that the vast majority of this is preventable if we just focus our resources on saving homes and lives.
Yeah, well, it's starting to sound a bit like a broken record because, you know, science tells us lots of things, and it's whether or not our society decides to listen to those things.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think it's also whether or not people hold politicians accountable. You know, we really need to do that. I think that, and I talk about this in my book, Smokescreen, you know, we need to hold politicians on both sides of the political aisle accountable, both Republicans and Democrats, because both parties are culpable on this issue in many ways. And both parties are proposing things that are wrongheaded and will actually make things worse. And so, and of course, at the individual level, there are certainly individual elected officials at the state level and the federal level who are promoting good things and are promoting the right things and promoting things that will help communities and actually protect our forests and mitigate climate change. But they're not the ones who are making the key decisions right now. And I think that, you know, that's something we really need to talk about as a society. And that's really when things are going to start changing.
If you're just joining us, our guest is forest ecology expert Dr. Chad Hansen, and we are talking about how natural landscapes recover from wildfires. Stay with us. This episode of Blue Dot is sponsored by the Gateway Science Museum in Chico, California. Learn more about their programs, including the Every Drop Impact Project Forum on September 14th, examining water sustainability during times of drought. Join scientists and gather data to help understand our most vital resource, fresh water. And watch paleontologists work with fossils live on site from noon to 3 Fridays and Saturdays, or tour some of the virtual exhibits online at csuchico.edu/gateway. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Our guest is ecologist Chad Hansen from the John Muir Project, and we are talking about how nature goes about renewal after a large wildfire. And what about the role of the indigenous people that lived here? Because there has been a lot more awareness recently about how they actually played, you know, a role in their own way in managing the landscape around here, because they wanted meadowlands for their medicinal plants and herbs and for hunting. And they actually used fire as a tool, didn't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. Native American cultural burning, you know, it has been going on for thousands of years in forests of this continent. And it was much more common before colonization and before land management policies and fire suppression policies. And the interesting thing, and this is what, you know, I think is really important, is that mixed intensity wildland fire from lightning strikes was also much more common historically. Both have been suppressed, both have been marginalized. And I think, you know, both have many, many impediments that are thrown up to prevent them from occurring. And I think that's a problem. I think that's wrong. I think those impediments should be reduced or removed. And I think we should facilitate more Native American cultural burning and remove impediments, as well as more mixed intensity wildland fire from lightning strikes, especially when it's, you know, further away from homes.
Yeah, it's interesting. You made me think of the recent loss of the Mount Harkness fire lookout in Lassen Volcanic National Park, where Ed Abbey famously wrote a lot of his great book, Desert Solitaire, one summer while he was up there as a fire lookout. But the purpose for the lookout originally was to spot, you know, lightning started fires and get them put out. And it's kind of, in a way, strangely ironic that, you know, fire destroyed it.
Yeah, it's certainly not the only example of that as well. You know, I think that we need to come to a new realization about wildland fire, a new relationship with fire. We need to accept that we're not gonna stop wildland fires from occurring, and we shouldn't. In fact, if we somehow were able to successfully do that, entire groups of plant and animal species, native plant and animal species that have been in these forests for millions of years, they would ultimately go extinct, because so many of the species in our forests, so much of the biodiversity depends on post-fire habitat. Fire's as natural in our forests and as necessary as sun and rain. It is intrinsic. Fire and mixed intensity fire is a process, is a shaping process. In our forests has been going on for 350 million years. So this is deep, deep evolutionary history. Our forests need fire. We don't want too much, we don't want too little, but I think what a lot of people don't realize is we actually have less fire now on average than we had historically. Now, of course, that may sound shocking in a big year like this. You know, 2021 is a big, big year, you know, relative to the last, you know, several decades. So is 2020. These are two big years. But bear in mind, you know, historically, they would have been, you know, somewhere more in the average range. And that doesn't mean that we want every year to be like this. But what it means is that these processes are being driven very, very heavily right now by weather and by climate factors. And we need to recognize that and recognize that, you know, we're gonna need to stop pulling so much carbon out of our forests. And because we know that most of that goes into the atmosphere when we do that, but we're also gonna need to kind of think adaptively and focus on communities in the face of these fires so we can protect people.
Yeah, well, let's talk about what happens after, because I find that really interesting and hopeful. For example, When you go up to Lassen Volcanic National Park, in the back part of the park behind Lassen Peak, there's the area where the Reading Fire burned through in 2012, and it was a big fire. And I remember, I think that's the first time I really saw a pyrocumulus cloud in my area, and since then I've seen many. But when you went up there just a couple years ago, it's strange because I call it the ghost forest because you just see all those snags and it's kind of creepy. But there's all this just incredibly verdant undergrowth, and the amount of insect life in there was just astounding to me, the butterflies and all the different pollinators. Could you talk a bit about what happens after one of these big fires, how the forests, go about regenerating?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a really important question because you're right. The science on this is ultimately quite hopeful. And I stress that point a lot in my book, Smokescreen, that what the science is telling us is that something that we should feel pretty good about, because I think a lot of people have thought for a long time, if you get a large fire, especially if it's a larger high intensity fire patch, they see it right after the fire and they see a bed of ash on the ground. They see these charred, fire killed trees. And a lot of people think it's going to look like that forever. It's just going to continue to look like that. But what actually happens is the first spring after the fire, it starts to change. And every spring thereafter, for years and years, it changes even more. And that change accelerates. And what you see is this wonderful proliferation of native plants that are, many of which are fire followers, and many of which are their germination, their reproduction, their proliferation is very strongly tied to the occurrence of fire, in some cases because of the heat, in other cases because of the smoke. And many of these species, you don't even, not a lot of the plant species, you don't even see for decades, in many cases, until the fire occurs. And then things that hadn't been seen for generations are seen. And same thing with a lot of the animals. You see a lot of woodpecker species, a lot of shrub nesting species in the post-fire habitat, what I call snag forests, that you don't see elsewhere. And it's because of two things. It's because of all those rich, wonderful fire-following flowering understory plants, wildflowers and flowering shrubs that grow in, that are stimulated by the fire. But it's also because of the snags themselves. And here's why snags matter. I'll just tell you just a little bit about this, because I think you'll find it interesting, and I think you'll find it hopeful. When a fire occurs, it basically does two things. It sends up heat, it sends up smoke. And there are dozens and dozens of native beetle species called wood-boring beetles that have evolved over countless millennia to depend on recently fire-killed trees to reproduce. And these species have receptors in their bodies that they've evolved to detect either the heat or the smoke of a wildland fire, depending on the species. And these beetles will fly, they're pretty good flyers, they're big beetles. They'll fly right towards the fire. They land on the charred bark of a fire-killed tree not long after the fire has passed. They lay their eggs, the larvae develop, they bore through the charred bark into the wood of the tree, and they develop over time into adults and then emerge and then go through another couple or a few cycles in that snag forest habitat until they need to fly away and find a new fire. And while those native wood-boring beetles are in their larval stage, in those snags, that's the primary food source for a number of different woodpecker species that have in turn evolved to depend on the larva of the wood-boring beetles as their food source. So, these woodpeckers need the fire-killed trees because that's where the food is, and they also need them because dead trees are softer than live trees and allows them to excavate their nest cavities. And the woodpeckers will excavate 2 to 4 nest cavities every single year. The male and the female share the duty, but the female picks the one she likes the best every spring, and these are monogamous species. She picks the one she likes the best. That's where they raise their young. And what that means is all the other cavities that they create every single year that they don't use, those are available to all the other cavity nesting species in the forest that have to have cavities in trees to raise their young, but can't create their own because they're not woodpeckers. So bluebirds, nuthatches, flying squirrels, chipmunks, dozens and dozens of bird and small mammal species. And of course, you can't have, if you don't have the fire that in patches that kill trees, then you don't have the wood-boring beetles. If you don't have the wood-boring beetles, you don't have the woodpeckers. And if you don't have the woodpeckers, you don't have the bluebirds and the nuthatches and the chipmunks and the other cavity nesting species. And then, of course, if those populations plummet, then, you know, you don't have food for coopershawks and goshawks and other things. And of course, you know, you've got even more species in the understory, the shrub nesters and the flying insects, butterflies and bees and small mammals in those down logs and shrubs. So this is a rich, colorful, interconnected ecosystem. And it's interesting because snag forest habitat is actually comparable to old growth forest in terms of native biodiversity and wildlife abundance. A lot of people don't realize that, but there's many, many, many studies now that back that up.
And I recall from walking through that area where the Nobles Immigrant Trail and Hat Creek go right through there in Lassen Park. It was interesting because like the first year I walked through there, it was kind of creepy and, you know, sad. It seemed sad at the time. But as the years went on, just a couple of years, really, I mean, I'm talking about, you know, 2012 to 2016, it was really a neat place to go because it was so green and there was just so much life going on that it kind of changed my attitude about it. And so what you're saying is that for these huge swaths of area that are just being incinerated by the Dixie Fire and Caldor right now and these other fires, that, you know, if what are they going to look like, let's say like in a year and then 5 years and 10 years, can you take us through to the future, what we will see as far as that goes?
Yeah. That's a great way to look at it. You know, so, first of all, even the biggest fires, these really big fires, they are pretty consistently mostly low and moderate intensity. And so that's another thing that's important to understand is that, you know, most of the areas that burn, most of the acreage within these big fires are going to be areas where small trees are killed, but even a lot of the medium-sized trees and most of the large trees are not. And in many cases, even a lot of the small trees are not killed. But then you also have patches where the fire burns hotter, where those winds really whip up. And it's really those serious hot, dry, windy conditions, which is when you get those higher intensity fire patches. And so that's really what we're talking about. That's where that real change occurs. That's where a new stand is initiated and where most or all the trees are killed. First thing you'll see next spring, you'll see shrubs starting to shoot up through the bed of ash. You've got this nutrient-rich bed of mineral ash that's created by the fire as all the pine needles and leaves and small twigs are consumed. And that bed of mineral ash spurs new life and growth for decades to come. You'll see wildflowers, especially lupin, but a number of dozens of different species of wildflowers coming through. You'll see new black oak shoots. You'll see black oaks where the top was killed, where the above ground tree was killed. You'll see them sprouting from the base. You'll see conifer regeneration, little conifer seedlings coming up here and there, but you'll see more the second year post-fire and even more the third year and the fourth year and the fifth year and so on. I know of areas in some of the biggest high intensity fire patches in the Rim Fire, for example, 257,000 acre fire that occurred in 2013 that I've been studying for years and years. Areas that had very little or no natural conifer regeneration for the first 3-4 years post-fire. And then all of a sudden at 5 years post-fire, you've got, and 6 years post-fire, you've got 200-300 conifer seedlings and saplings per acre. Just remarkable. And in some cases, now that's already over 12 feet tall, just 8 years post-fire. Just amazing. And of course, you know, even in the places where the conifers don't come in right away, which, you know, in many places they will, most places they will. But you'll get the wildflowers, you'll get the shrubs and the black oak and in certain places aspen, and it's going to turn into this rich, colorful ecosystem, and you're going to start seeing that next spring. It's just going to get starting, and then a lot of the wildlife species that really depend on post-fire habitat, they'll start colonizing. A little bit at first in the first year, more in the second year, even more in the third year post-fire. And that's going to build and build and build for at least 30 years post-fire until the regenerating forest, you know, really kind of grows into and matures into a mid-successional forest. And then, you know, you don't have snag forest habitat anymore, you know, so it's naturally ephemeral. It's fleeting. And that makes it in many ways, you know, ecologically important and precious.
Yeah, you know, if you think about like I keep thinking of Lassen Volcanic National Park because it's my favorite place, and watching this fire burn through it, there's been a little bit traumatic the last few weeks. You know, it's a volcanic area, and in 1915, Lassen unleashed a small pyroclastic blast that knocked down a lot of the forest and just, you know, created what's called the devastated area, and it was just barren. And yet now, if you go there 100 years later, you know, it was 100 years ago, 2015, 100 and a few years, people look at it and go, what's devastated about this? Because it's all forested.
That's right. That's right. And of course, there are other examples as well. And whether it's an intense natural disturbance process like a volcanic blast, or whether it's a large high-intensity fire patch, you know, they're not exactly the same, but you see the same kind of natural regeneration afterwards. Because, of course, these processes are very, very old, and these ecosystems are very, very old. And they've been responding to these processes evolutionarily for millions and millions of years. And so, you know, nature's got this covered, you know, and it's understandable from a human standpoint to react to it, because, you know, we develop emotional attachments to places and the way they look, you know, in the experience of our lifetimes. But it's also important to understand that, you know, not all change is bad. And sometimes I think we'll find that if we, you know, give nature a chance, if we don't post-fire log these areas and go in and artificially plant trees, which is really, really destructive, if we do that, it will basically undermine most of the really good, important, you know, ecological richness I'm talking about. But if we leave it to natural processes and trust nature, I think what we'll find is that these post-fire areas, in many ways, we're going to appreciate just as much. In some ways, we might even appreciate them more, you know, years after the fire.
Well, is there any role that companies that rely on timber harvesting can play that it's more positive in this point of view? Because, you know, we still use wood products for a variety of things and, you know, extract them from forests. Is there a way to do that that makes more sense?
Well, I mean, certainly there are different types of logging practices. You know, clear cutting, you know, is widely recognized as being very destructive because it, you know, basically eliminates the entire ecosystem down to the stumps and bare ground. Commercial thinning is, you know, seen as, you know, something that's an alternative to that. But, you know, that's also, you know, while it's leaving, you know, a number of the mature trees, it's also killing and removing most of the smaller understory trees and sort of clear cutting the understory of the forest, which is where a lot of the biodiversity is. I think the answer for me is this, is that, you know, logging is, whether you're talking about clear cutting or thinning, logging is not something that has an evolutionary precedent. But there's a lot of things in our human society that don't have an evolutionary precedent. And I think we need to be honest and recognize that these are not things that the ecosystem needs. They're not things that are benefiting the ecosystem. In many cases, they're causing a lot of harm. And so I think, you know, for me, the conversation is how do we reduce those harms? How do we minimize those impacts? We're going to continue to use wood products tomorrow and the next day and next year. But I do think that we need to use less. And there's a broad consensus in the scientific community, among climate scientists, among forest ecologists, recognizing that. In fact, I'm a lead author of a letter from over 200 scientists to Congress last year that made this argument. We said, look, we know that this is not going to happen overnight. And we know that it's not like we're not going to use any wood products at all in the future as a society. But we need to start shifting away from wood consumption for lumber, for biomass energy. We need to use clean energy. Biomass energy is not. We need to start using non-wood alternatives to the greatest extent possible, reducing our wood consumption, building smaller houses, using recycled alternatives wherever we can. We need to do better because we need to store more carbon in our forests. We need our forests to absorb more carbon from the atmosphere because our atmospheric CO2 levels are dangerously high. They're too high and they're going up. They're continuing to go up. We need to reverse that. Our best way to do that is not only to get away from fossil fuels as quickly as possible, which we have to do, but that's not enough anymore. We have to also protect natural ecosystems, especially forests, so they can draw down atmospheric carbon. And by the way, it's good for biodiversity, and it's also good for communities, because if we're not spending billions and billions of dollars and logging subsidies, subsidizing logging in backcountry forests, we can use those funds to save homes and lives and communities and protect them from wildland fire.
It's interesting you mentioned smaller homes, because I live in a home that was built in the 1960s, much like the one I grew up in as a child. And it's not a big house. And yet when I look around me in my neighborhood at homes that have been built in more recent years, they're gigantic.
Yeah, that's right. And it hasn't always been that way. You know, there was a trend for a while, and this is still going on in a lot of places where, you know, people are expecting a 4,000 square foot home, you know, for a new home, or a 3,500 square foot home, or sometimes even bigger. And, you know, it was a very, very normal thing for a very long time for the average size family, you know, typically a family of four, to live in a home that was 1,600 square feet, 1,000 square feet, 1,200 square feet. My wife grew up in a house that was built in the early 1960s that was somewhere between 1,000 and 1,100 square feet, and for a family of four. And the house doesn't feel small. It's a three-bedroom, two-bath house. It's got a nice living room, a nice kitchen, and is very, very intelligently laid out. And you know, we don't need to facilitate continued excess. I think we just, you know, we're going to need to be smarter, and we're going to need to do things a little bit differently, you know, in order to, you know, for the greater good, for the forest and for the climate and for communities.
I was wondering if I could actually just ask a quick kind of a follow-up. It's something you were talking about a little earlier.
Matt?
I mean, I understand how we need to consume less wood, especially for building homes in these fire-prone areas. But it has been pointed out to me a lot that, you know, wood is a very renewable resource that we have out in the West. And then, of course, you add in that millions of acres in California are owned by logging companies that invested in these forests for the payback of lumber. And I'm just wondering if there are practices where these companies could do things better, where...
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean,
where not like it stops or...
I think moving forward, it's a combination of things. I think... You know, in my view, we should protect the federal public lands from logging. And, you know, I don't think the Forest Service should be in the logging business. I think when it comes to private lands, there are a number of private landowners that would be perfectly happy to sell. So it could be acquired into protected ownership. And that's the choice they would make. And that would be, you know, to their benefit, you know, from willing sellers. There are others that want to keep those lands in private ownership and even in timber production, but they'd be perfectly happy to be financially incentivized to log less, to reduce logging levels by 50%, let's say, to double the rotation interval. So I think there's a lot of different things that we can do, even on lands where logging continues, on private lands, to incentivize that. And this, you know, my view on this is that this is something where it's not about regulation as much as it's about incentivization.
I just want to kind of confirm then, you don't believe that there's any place for logging within our federal lands as any sort of useful ecological land management strategy?
No. And that doesn't mean that no tree would ever get cut, because there's some places where you have to do that.
Right, of course.
Right, like a hazard tree, right? Like next to a main recreation road. You want to cut that tree down.
Right. It's not there's no removal of trees, but there's just no logging for lumber.
Exactly. So basically, it's much more like national parks. National parks are not in the commercial logging business. In my view, national forests should be in a similar way.
Let's take a short break, but stay with us as we talk about forests and wildfire and the ecology of recovery with Chad Hansen from the John Muir Project. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. Let's return now to my conversation with Chad Hansen. He's the principal ecologist for the John Muir Project, a nonprofit dedicated to smarter forestry and fire practices on public lands like the national forests. And what would be some recommendations you would have for communities that are in fire-prone areas? What are some of the most important ways to harden those and make those safer places so that when the people do get out, they have a home to return to?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it comes down to a few key things. I mean, there are less important things on the checklist, but these ones are really, really key. The first one I'll mention, I mean, for the main thing is the home itself. And this first one is really inexpensive, relatively speaking, you know, oftentimes just a few hundred bucks In many cases, the homes will be saved, which is ember-proof vents, just to prevent those flaming embers from being driven by winds in advance of the flames, sometimes a mile or two or more in advance of flames by the winds, preventing them from being pushed into an attic vent, an old, you know, coarse wire, coarse mesh attic vent, you know, that was put on in the 1960s or 70s or 80s. And replace those with you know, a fine wire mesh, you know, in modern ember-proof vents. There's a number of different companies that make these. They're all pretty good. And, you know, in many cases, the majority of homes that burn wildland fires are burning from the embers. That is pretty common for most homes to burn from the embers, not from direct contact with the flames. And so it's not about modifying the fire so much as making sure that the homes don't burn when the embers land there, because they will. Oftentimes the homes are already, you know, in flames and in flaming ruins before the fire even gets to the community. So that's a key one. And the other ones are simple things like sweeping the dry pine needles and dry leaves off the roof every fire season, just making sure they don't accumulate. Simple things like rain gutter guards, that'll keep those dry leaves and pine needles from accumulating in the rain gutter right next to the roof. Because again, if an ember lands on the roof and rolls down into 4-inch deep dry leaves and pine needles, it's going to cause an ignition right next to the roof, and that can catch the roof on fire. And then, of course, you're talking about things like defensible space pruning. And this is not, you know, cutting mature trees around your house. You know, this is really about light touch stuff. Less is more when this is concerned. It's really about, you know, making sure that dry grasses are cleared adjacent to the house, you know, mostly the first 60 feet away from the home. And the most important is the first 10 feet. First 30 feet. You're making sure that, you know, dry, you know, twigs and pine needles are kept away from, you know, the closest proximity to the house, removing lower limbs on mature trees, you know, up to about 6 feet above the ground. Making sure you don't have dense concentrations of small trees close to the house. Making sure you don't have branches that touch second story decks, for example. That's something that can cause an ignition. Mostly it's simple things like that. And, you know, and there are folks, a lot of folks have the resources to do that, and that's great, but not everyone does. And this is where I think, you know, we really need to have a conversation about shifting our priorities, because right now we've got billions of dollars of subsidies for the wrong things that are making things worse and putting people at risk. And we could redirect those subsidies into creating a whole lot of jobs, actually creating fire safe communities.
Yeah, well, that makes total sense to me. And especially, like you said, many of these homes, they burn from the inside out, not the other way around.
That's right. And in fact, you'll see this every fire season. These pictures come up, and a lot of people don't, you know, realize what they're looking at, but they see the charred ruins of a house that burned. And then trees next to it that are mostly green, but are partially scorched. Well, in many cases, these are trees that were scorched by the house, not the house scorched and ignited by the trees.
Like you said, that's not a terribly expensive thing to do, to get those fireproof guards where the vents are, especially in older homes, like you say. I'd like to just find out a bit about how did you first get interested in forest ecology and in fires in particular? When did you first get interested in this?
Well, I've loved forests my whole life. I started backpacking when I was 11 in my Boy Scout troop that I joined when I was 11 years old. All we were was just a really hardcore backpacking club. We backpacked once every month somewhere in the Southern California mountains or in the Sierra Nevada, in the summer, of course, in the Sierra Nevada. We did it every single month, including in the middle of winter. We'd hike in over snow and camp out. And so I developed a love for wild places and forests and mountains at a very young age. I had this dream that I would hike the Pacific Crest Trail from Mexico to Canada. I read a National Geographic article about that when I was 15 years old. And I finally, you know, took the opportunity to do that toward the end of college. I took a year off, and my older brother and I hiked it from Mexico all the way to Canada. And of course, you know, once we got to the northern Sierra Nevada on the national forest, we started seeing all the devastation from logging and huge areas where the whole landscape had been just denuded by clear cuts. And we saw more and more of that on national forest lands and private lands, but mostly, you know, this trail goes mostly on federal lands, all the way up through Oregon and Washington to Canada. And I was really shocked by what I saw. And when I got back, I decided to get involved in forest conservation. I was a pre-med student at that time. I changed career paths and decided I was going to, dedicate my life to protecting forests. One thing that came up is that increasingly, as I worked to protect forests, these questions were coming up about fire and about, you know, what it means when a fire occurs. And increasingly, especially by the time the 90s rolled around, the logging industry and the Forest Service stopped using the term logging. They stopped using the term timber sale or timber harvest. Everything became forest health or fuel reduction or restoration. And I became curious about these terms and the scientific basis for them, and increasingly skeptical because I was seeing on the ground, because I'm a boots on the ground guy, I'm a field ecologist first and foremost. I started seeing a lot of the same logging I was seeing in the 1980s, being done under different banners. I remember there's one day I was actually in a post-fire area in the central Sierra Nevada, and we were going to check on a spotted owl nest stand after the fire, the year after the fire. And there was a logging crew cutting down a patch of snag forest habitat that had burned at high intensity. And they had to stop what they were doing to let us pass so we could get further down the road to this area that burned more lightly, was mostly still green trees where the owls were nesting. And the foreman of the felling crew wanted to talk, and he asked me, he said, "Look, I understand why you guys don't want us to cut down those green trees down the road. But this area here burned hot. It's been, all the trees are dead. As far as I can tell, it's been destroyed. What wildlife species could possibly use this? What harm could possibly come from cutting it down?" And this was 2002, summer of 2002. I did not have an answer for him at that time. I had no idea how to answer his question, but I thought it was a really, really good and smart question and an important one. And the question stayed with me, and I found myself spending a lot of time in research libraries and digging into that question. And what I found intrigued me, and what I was finding is that research was indicating, even at that time, that these areas were incredibly important for a whole lot of wildlife species that depend on dead trees or the understory vegetation that grows in patches that burn intensely. And so ultimately that led me back to graduate school, and I got my PhD in ecology focused on that issue.
Yeah, and that is so the way science works, is that you get a question that you become passionate about that you can't answer. And then you spend, your time and efforts trying to figure out the answer to that question. So now you could answer that guy's question, right?
I absolutely can. But, of course, as is always the case in science, the more you learn, the more you realize there is to learn. And so there are many questions that I think are interesting that we still are asking and trying to answer. But I will say that there are now literally, since that time, there have been hundreds of scientific studies published on this question, specifically on this question about the ecological value and importance of these post-fire areas, particularly where fire burns at high intensity, the natural regeneration, the biodiversity of plants and animals. And again, to your point earlier in the conversation, that the science, what it's telling us, is ultimately very positive and hopeful.
Yeah, and that was the reason I wanted to have you on the show, because I found your take on it to be very refreshing and hopeful, because, it's easy to fall into the trap of seeing these just massive amount of smoke and thinking, the entire region is being destroyed, when really it's just a case of natural renewal.
Yeah, that's right. And, again, we don't want too much fire. We don't want too little. But I think, we shouldn't be focusing so much on the size of the fire. Instead, we should be focusing on the acreage burned. And what we're experiencing right now is not outside the natural range of variability, historically, ecologically, for these forests. And so I think, again, that means our focus needs to be on the thing that we really can control and where we really can make an improvement through our actions, which is making sure to keep people safe.
Well, and I know you hear a lot from the firefighters saying, you know, they're seeing conditions and fire behavior they've never seen before. What's your take on that briefly?
Well, you know, that's not true. I mean, we've certainly seen big, intense, you know, fire patches in the past, and you know, certainly, you know, any individual firefighter may not have been on a fire that was large, or, you know, where there was a large high intensity fire patch. But, you know, we've seen, you know, bigger fires. We've seen big fires in the past. You know, certainly the Dixie Fire is the biggest one in recent decades. You know, we don't really have records that go back prior to 1950. They're very spotty and very, very inconsistent, and there are huge gaps. We do know from fire scar studies back in the 1800s and, you know, back farther, that there were certain years, you know, usually about 10 or a dozen in a given century, that were really big fire years, and typically in big drought years. And in many of these years, you know, we don't know exactly, because there's no records, you know, specifically to tell us exactly how big the fires are. But we know we have, you know, entire landscapes where there's multiple areas where there's fire scar studies that are all recording fire scars in the same year across all, you know, the trees, you know, consistently in those fire scar studies, study after study after study. And that indicates that in certain years we had huge fires across, you know, vast areas of the landscape. And so I don't think these fires are unprecedented. But you know, it's going to be interesting to see, you know, the natural richness that comes in the rejuvenation of the forest and the regrowth in the years to come.
Well, I know I'm going to look forward to going up and checking these things out, and because it's not far from me, and these are my favorite places, and looking at it through the lens that you've provided us today. So thanks for joining us, Chad. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Well, it was my pleasure, and thank you so much for the invite.
Thanks again to our guest, Chad Hansen, co-founder and principal ecologist for the John Muir Project. You can check out their website at johnmuirproject.org. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in Northern California. We're distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. You can check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org and subscribe to our podcast using the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot. Thank you.